Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
I'm Linda Palacio, host of A Taste of the Past. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Well, hello, and welcome to Chef Story. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and today this is the very first interview we're doing from Expo Milano 2015, and I am thrilled because, appropriately, our very first chef that we're interviewing is Mark Ladner of Del Posto in New York. For those of you who might not know Mark, which I think are probably three people now in America, he is the executive chef at Del Posto and has been since the opening in 2005. They are the first time, and I think in about 40 years, the New York Times finally gave 4 stars to an Italian restaurant, and Mark was the chef at the helm. Of course, the restaurant's owned, a lot of people know, by the Bastianiches, Joe and Lydia, and Mario Batali, but actually Mark is the chef there and always has been. It received a Michelin star. It's a grand restaurant in the Relais and Chateau. It has a grand award from the Wine Spectator, 5 diamonds, going on and on and on, you know, from AAA. And Mark himself started at Babbo as a sous chef, and then he opened all the other restaurants, it seems, for the Bastianiches. Lupa, Otto Inateca, and then finally you became a partner in Del Posto. So we're going to get into a lot of other things that you're doing, so welcome. And we are sitting in the 7-star Galleria restaurant, James Beard restaurant, in downtown Milan at the Galleria, right across from the Duomo. And Mark is here with his team opening the JBF American restaurant in Milan. Welcome, welcome, welcome.
Thank you very much, Dorothy. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for taking the time to sit down with me for a little bit.
Okay, so I'm just going to get the microphone closer. There may be background noise because we are in the restaurant, and I apologize in advance. But, you know, last night I introduced you saying you're from Rhode Island, but you're really from Belmont, Massachusetts.
I'm from Belmont, yes. I spent most of my formative years in Cambridge, in Harvard Square. That's where I started cooking. So,
why there?
I lived and went to high school in Belmont, which is it borders Cambridge. Mm-hmm. And Harvard Square was sort of obviously the meeting point for a lot of the, academics that happened in and around Boston. As young punks, we would hang out in Harvard Square, either skateboarding or, doing illicit activities and entertaining ourselves. Trying not to get, chased by police. And, I gradually eventually found myself in restaurants, and it was easy for me to get there, and I didn't need a chaperone, and that's where we would,
Okay, so before we jump to your culinary career, so you were a skateboard aficionado.
I was.
Yeah, trying to stay away from the police,
yes.
Right. So what kind of food were you eating in those days?
Oh, the American staples, hamburgers, pizza, club sandwiches, greasy spoon, American stuff primarily, yeah.
And what kind of food did you have at home?
I was what would be considered at that point in time a latchkey kid. Mm-hmm. My mother worked full time. My parents were divorced. Mm-hmm. So my younger sister and I, really took care of ourselves. It didn't seem strange at the time. At this point, child services would probably get involved if parents did what, mine did to me. But I didn't feel, disadvantaged or, neglected in any way. It just sort of was the way it was.
So did you have an interest in cooking at that age?
I did always have an interest in food. I don't come from a family that has, much traditional food background. My mother's family is French-Canadian from Alberta. Oh. So there was some of that, especially, around holidays and things. My mother also, when I was younger, spent time managing salad bars, which, as you know, were quite popular in the 70s, and ironically becoming quite popular again. So, one of my first sort of really fond memories of food is being introduced to and immediately falling in love with the canned chickpea. That was my portal to obsession.
How did somebody in Belmont, Massachusetts, do you even pick that up in a grocery?
No, it was at the salad bar. It's a salad bar.
That's
true.
Yeah. And you like the
texture. So grazing the texture, I really enjoyed the flavor. I mean, it's a modern miracle how they're able to make everyone perfectly cooked in those cans. I even like that sort of sodium benzoate syrup a little bit.
Well, just a little sidebar, because she's Italian, Marcella Hazan was, I used to send her Swiss chard from my garden, mm-hmm. and she called me one day to thank me, mm-hmm. and she said, I'm making my favorite dish, which was sautéing the Swiss chard with chickpeas, and she said, only use Goya. Yeah. She said, she was an aficionado of those canned chickpeas.
Wow.
She says, Dorothy, you don't have to, make the chickpea from scratch.
Yeah.
Also, two chickpeas now. Chickpeas are making it. Yeah.
That's where it's at. Yeah.
So, do you use them a lot in your cooking now?
I mean, obviously, my cooks try to keep me honest, and we cook. We actually get our chickpeas from Cesare, so it's like the romantic notion of one side of one hill, and
That's Cesare Casella, from the Bean Republic, is it called?
Republic
of Beans. You can get them on the internet or at Salumeria Rossi in New York.
Alma Gourmet carries them as well, distributes them. Yeah.
Okay.
So we use a lot of those. That's one thing that I definitely learned from Cesare is that similar to a lot of things, even particularly with dried legumes, using from the most recent vintage is really the best. They sort of reconstitute pretty evenly.
Mm. Yeah. Well, that lesson in chickpeas. So then how did you decide to go to culinary school?
Pretty much from the moment I started working in restaurants, I knew that this was what I wanted to be. So.
What was it that appealed to you?
Well, it's obviously very different than, 25 years ago or 30 years ago than it is now. It was much more the fringe of society, sort of the romance of, the pirate ship that that Anthony Bourdain speaks of a lot. degenerates, ex-cons, drug addicts. That sort of thing. Really the camaraderie of kitchens, that sort of maybe even surrogate family sort of mentality. Mm-hmm. I also really enjoyed the idea of not sort of submitting to the 9-to-5, desk culture from very early on. Also the idea of being, active and utilizing, multiple senses simultaneously. Like a lot of us chefs being sort of, ADD and that sort of thing. And then proximity to alcohol and other things like that, of course.
I love honest answers. So you went to cooking school. And what was your mindset when you went into cooking school? Was it to become the James Beard Award-winning Best Chef of New York, which you just won?
I thought that I was good enough to be able to eventually be able to make the kind of food that I thought that I would one day want to. I didn't know what that would be, but, I really truly believe that as long as you can make food taste the way that you like, I don't really think that you need to spend a tremendous amount of time continuing to polish your culinary skills. I mean, I think that you can like waste a lot of time, you know, spelunking down the rabbit hole for culinary greatness when, in this day and age, you know, from a entrepreneurial and business perspective, there's such a broad range of skill sets necessary to be successful in this industry that spending too much time trying to like perfect a bite of food might not be the best utilization of your time.
That's a great observation. So you got out of culinary school, you went to Johnson & Wales, and they're going to be honoring you with a PhD, an honorary PhD. I mean, my gosh.
You don't even know where to compartmentalize that.
Well, now when you make a reservation, you can call yourself Dr. Ladner.
That will never happen, for the record, on the record.
I'm sure. So how did you get attracted to Italian food?
So I have a theory on this. I think that when you're a young person and your filters are sort of open, you tend to be, you know, more heavily influenced by your first experiences. And the first restaurants that I worked in were primarily sort of mom and pop pizza, you know, sub sandwich kind of places. And it just sort of, you know, resonated with me. I actually left Johnson & Wales. I didn't actually graduate.
I have a
culinary school, but I didn't finish the business management school.
Yeah.
Because I got a job working for Todd English.
Oh.
At the original Olives. Did you ever go to that restaurant?
I didn't,
it was so extraordinary.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that was obviously a more formidable and formative education into Italian food and wine and culture. But at the time, this would have been like 91 maybe, Todd English had a small restaurant in Charlestown, Massachusetts that was only 30 seats. It was open 5 nights a week with a wood grill, a wood oven, and a wood rotisserie. And like,
a wood rotisserie.
A wood oven, wood grill, wood rotisserie. Only 30 seats. Todd cooked on the line every night. Barbara Lynch was standing right next to him. It was like this incredible. There were only like 7 or 8 employees. It was a really, really incredible opportunity for me. And so I left school to pursue.
To go to graduate school.
Yeah, to pursue that. So I stayed in Boston for a couple of years before I...
At Olives?
Yes, until I got the confidence to try to make it in Manhattan.
What brought you to Manhattan?
I knew I had come here when my father ran the marathon in 1978, and he brought us with him. And I knew immediately, I've always been an urbanite and knew that I wanted to live in cities. So then in college, I came back to visit friends and knew it was where I wanted to be. I just didn't feel I was ready yet. In the early 90s, it was still, I mean, as you know, it was still pretty edgy, and it was harder to sort of make your way, I think, in Manhattan, especially on a entry-level cook's salary.
And also, the European chefs were still pretty ascendant.
Oh, my God. It was completely francophile.
Yes.
Completely.
Maybe Jonathan Waxman might have been one of the few Americans.
Yeah. Yeah, jams. For sure. There wasn't... Peter Hoffman.
Yeah, Peter Hoffman.
Was doing really interesting American food. It was before Gramercy Tavern. It was super... Yeah, it was super francophile still. All of the la and the... And yeah, coming from Olives, I had sort of like more like rustic farm-to-table food even back then, and there was no such thing as the upper
had he spent
in Manhattan.
Yeah, had he spent a lot of time in Italy? Was it his?
He worked his two primary influences were he worked at Le Cote Basque for Rachou, and he worked at Dal Pescatore for Nadia Santini.
I see.
And I think it's in Lombardia.
So he was doing authentic Italian food.
At that time he was, yeah. His food then sort of evolved into more like American sort of tall food, and then it kind of went from there. But at that time it was very, very rooted.
So was that your that was your first introduction to the taste
like
of the authentic?
Really professional kitchen, yeah.
So we're just going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to delve into New York years.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Are you a locavore? Our Northeast regional forager for Whole Foods Market sure is. She spends her time traveling around the New York City metro area sourcing the best new or interesting artisanal and handcrafted local products for our purchasing teams at the local store level. Part of our commitment to our local suppliers includes assisting them with the process of getting their products sold at our stores. Whether it's suggesting packaging designs, pricing, or distribution methods, she's helping some of the area's best new products reach savvy shoppers at Whole Foods Market stores. Today, New York. Tomorrow, the world. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Chef's Story, and today, my guest in Milano, because we're at the Expo, is the most recent 2015 James Beard Foundation New York Outstanding Best Chef, Mark Ladner. And we're so happy to have you.
Thank you very much, Dorothy.
And to have you cooking at the James Beard restaurant in Milan. So you get to New York. Were you totally focused on Italian restaurants?
No, I actually worked in some American restaurants. At the time, you could still work for cash. So I was sort of gigging around, so to speak, trying to get a sense of sort of the landscape. As most people probably know, you know, trying to navigate the, you know, New York in general, it can be overwhelming in almost any industry. So it takes a while. You really have to do your homework. And, you know, I dined out for a lot of inexpensive lunches to try to see what people's sort of styles were and things like that. I was then fortunate enough to get into the kitchen of a guy by the name of Scott Bryan, who's sort of like a chef's chef. You don't really hear much about him these days, but let me assure you, he's one of the greatest chefs of all time, greatest cooks. In fact, Anthony Bourdain wrote an entire chapter on Scott in Kitchen Confidential. You should go back and check it out. He's an amazing guy. Yeah, I worked with him first at Allison on Dominick Street, which I'm sure you remember, and then we were at a restaurant called Luma, which was on 9th Avenue, and then we opened a place called Indigo, which was like a really inexpensive restaurant. That was sort of the beginning of that time in Manhattan when Mario was really doing amazing inexpensive food at Poe. And then Jean-Claude Iacovelli was doing all that stuff in Soho with, like, Soho Steak and Jean-Claude in those restaurants. So that was when sort of that 25 and under category was really great. And again, this is when cash was still king. So things were different, yeah. So I spent almost 4 years with him.
So how wild was it back then? I mean,
it wasn't actually wild at all, except that there were less rules because it was harder to keep track of rules. You know, it was like pre-internet. You know, the IRS wasn't able to follow things as closely because there wasn't record.
Right. Was it a lot easier for a chef to start their own restaurant back then? An American chef.
I would say that it was, except that people didn't seem to be necessarily as entrepreneurial, willing to take sort of the risk. It didn't seem as attainable a goal, maybe, as it seems today, because there's so much information, and you hear so much about people encouraging people to be entrepreneurial. And that I don't remember that being so much the case then.
Well, let's return to that in a bit. So when did you meet the Mario Batali Bastianich?
That would be about the time. So, you know, I was good friends, and I would eat at... I lived in the village all during this time, and I would spend... I would eat at Poe because it was really inexpensive. It was really delicious, and I could afford it. Mario was there cooking every night. I became friends with his manager, Jason Denton, who later became my business partner. And I was really inspired by that style of restaurant, and I thought that that's the kind of restaurateur I wanted to be. Lo and behold, by the time I felt I was ready, that model had already sailed and it was gone.
What made you know you were ready?
Well, I was about to have a kid, so that helped sort of put things in perspective. And I also felt like I was at that point where I could make food taste the way that I wanted it to taste. And I think that that's an interesting and an important sort of benchmark, because as I mentioned earlier, you can definitely spelunk down the rabbit hole and chase the craft around the world, you know, for an entire career. But, I just don't know how necessary that doesn't necessarily is. Also, once you have your own kitchen, it doesn't necessarily mean that you stop learning, you know.
So you felt that you're ready to...
Yes.
To stop looking at everybody else's...
Yes.
Yeah. And so... How did you wind up at Babbo? Was that this time? That
it was a little bit before that. I was cooking at Jean Georges with some friends of mine, including one of your esteemed alumni, is Wiley. So Wiley actually got me the job at Jean Georges. I've been friends with Wiley for many years. As much as I enjoyed that experience, and I very much wanted to see what a four-star kitchen was like, and wanted to be able to say, you know, I had worked in a four-star kitchen, and I do think that you need the exposure just so that you can understand the kind of expectations that people have, particularly people like Jean-Georges or Danielle, you know, that have only ever lived in that culture. But I missed Italian food, and I was already friendly with Mario. And when I knew that he was opening Babbo, I went and found him and asked him if I could work with him.
Oh. And what did he say?
So I remember clearly. So he took me into the backyard of Babbo. I'm sorry, of Poe. And we sat down on these two little plastic lawn chairs, and he asked me for my resume, and I didn't know really what a resume was. I'd never used one before because it was still...
It's a lot of word of mouth.
It was word of mouth, and it was, exactly. He knew my past because he was friendly with my former bosses. And then he took me directly to Barnes & Noble on 6th Avenue and 8th Street and bought me Lynn Rosetta Casper's The Splendid Table, Marcella Hazan, The River Cafe, and Voltero...
Marchese.
No, Marchese. Bugiali.
Oh, Bugiali.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
So I spent the next couple months devouring those, and yeah.
So how did the initial menu come about?
Everything. I didn't know any of this stuff. It was a really pivotal opening, I think, in the landscape of Manhattan dining, certainly for that time, but also in reference to Italian food in New York and how it was perceived and how it was presented. And it really was a crossover because Mario was so heavily influenced by California cuisine. And And he was doing, like, really, you know, wacky stuff. We were using a lot of offal that people had never seen and certainly had never championed. You know, the beef cheeks and lots of tongue and sweetbreads and things like that. But the amazing thing was that he was able to convince people that not only they should eat it, but that they should like it. And he was very convincing.
Yes.
I mean, if you've ever met Mario Batali.
Yeah.
And it's also delicious. I mean, you know, I think that's half the reason people, they taste things and it's not delicious and then they write it off.
No question.
So were you in a huge learning stage? You were chef.
I was, yes.
And Mario was the chef?
Mario was the chef. Andy Nusser was the chef, who had been already with Mario for 5 years at Poe and who went on to become the chef of Casamono and Bar Jamon. And now a lot of the Terry Lodge restaurants that they're propagating through the state of Connecticut.
Uh-huh. So, Lupa was the first
that
you...
1 year later, we opened Lupa.
And you became the chef there.
You
were the magical chef there. I remember people telling me, you know what, somebody called you Puck, you know, from...
Oh, that was my good friend Sam Sifton.
Yes.
No, he's not my good friend.
Well,
like it very much.
Yeah, no, because it was very, I don't know, it just captured a robustness, an authenticity, a whole feel. It was so tiny.
I was really obsessed with authenticity at that time. I feel like I had sort of an insecurity complex because I had never worked in Italy. I didn't speak Italian. At that point, I hadn't even been to Italy yet. And so I was just like hell-bent on trying to produce, you know, these austere, incredibly traditional recipes the best I could.
They were
yeah.
So delicious.
Yeah,
so
now
you're in...
Because
you can't do it as simple. It was a much.
I mean, it's common now, but you know, rustic Italian food at that time was not common. There weren't a lot of restaurants that did that. Now you can find one on probably every corner of Manhattan.
You can't find Lupus on every corner.
No,
of Manhattan.
I know it's still a great restaurant. I haven't been involved in several years, but yeah, I've...
So that was the first kitchen you were entirely in charge of. So what were some of the things that you brought to your kitchen that you think really define you as a chef?
I think that there are two things that I'm really adamant about. One is a monkish devotion to pasta, but specifically the cooking and saucing of, which I think is often overlooked, rather than the making or stuffing or all of that stuff. I think that the execution in the last several minutes is something that people don't spend enough time obsessing over, which I think is what really makes the difference for me. And also learning, obviously, how to manage people. You know, I was young at the time, so I was managing, you know, essentially peers. I don't know if I was necessarily, you know, mature enough to be a great role model. But I did know that it was important to remove as much variable for error from the equation before service so that while you were doing service, you could just focus on service.
Are you a highly organized person?
Not really.
No?
I'm not. I mean, I can be,
yes.
And I've been trained to be, but it
yes.
doesn't, it's not like innately
it's
in
not
me.
Innate.
No, I learned it.
So I have to ask at this time, is this when you chose your hat? And why?
I always liked hats, and then my hair fell out, and now I wear hats to cover my cold head.
No, but I mean, you don't wear a chef's toque. That's what I'm talking about.
I had to wear a toque. I used to wear baseball hats and things like that. And then at Jean George, I had to wear a toque. But it was a disaster because I was much too tall and the hoods were much too short. And I would just walk in with a Bashton hat half the day, which was just another reason for them to yell at me. So I swore those off in like 97.
But you have a signature hat.
And this is because the reason that I wear these hats is because we wanted something that was white. Like, as you can see, I really appreciate representing the traditional garb. Mm-hmm. And the hat was mainly because, you know, in an effort to try to combat the local Department of Health, they insist that you wear a hat. We at Del Posto at times can be up to 200 employees. So a dinner service is 25 cooks, just cooks. So then with prep cooks and porters and dishwashers, it can obviously climb from there. So I felt that if I was going to walk around telling people to wear hats, that I should be wearing a hat too. So it just makes it easier, because if I'm wearing a hat, I'm like, if I got to wear this fucking thing, sure as shit, you're going to wear this fucking thing. Right? It just makes it so much
easier. But I'm talking about the style of the hat, because I've never seen another chef wear that style. Was it? Is there any?
Fry. It's just a fry.
Yeah, it looks like a fry. Yeah, it's a very, you know, humble hat.
They're disposable. They're, I don't know, I like them white. They come in different colors.
Okay, so we got the hat. That was one of my
really
big questions.
It's really the health department.
Okay, so you wouldn't, if it wasn't for the health department.
Yeah, and trying to lead by example. You know.
Okay, we're going to take a little break. We'll be right back. You're listening to Chef Story, and it's Dorothy Cann Hamilton today with Mark Ladner in the 7-star Galleria Hotel, which houses the James Beard Foundation American Restaurant in Milan, celebrating the expo. And this is the very first interview we're doing for Heritage Radio from Milan and the expo. And I'm thrilled because Mark Ladner just flew in from Chicago, where he won New York's Best Chef from the James Beard Foundation, and had to be plunged into a cocktail party for 200 and dinner for 90, two nights in a row. And how are you feeling?
It's going really well. I love Milan.
Yeah. So when was your first trip to Italy, and what was that like after cooking all this food? Your expectations must have been
gone. It was, we had probably been open. Lupa had been open for about 3 or 4 months, and Jason and I took like a very well-curated trip through Rome. Lupa was always intended to be a Roman osteria, so we were trying to better familiarize ourselves with very, very traditional Roman food. In fact, today, I don't know, is it okay if I launch into something different?
Sure.
So today, one of my favorite pavilions at the Expo was the Italy Pavilion. And as you had recommended, there is a representative from each of the 20 regions. And it's not just, it's sort of a pop-up, but it's also like a very well-respected regional chef. And lo and behold, I get to Lazio, and Anna Dente from Osteria San Cesario is there with her son Emilio. And she is like, her place is, how should I describe it? It's in Amatrice, where Amatriciana is from. And she has like the tre gambero, so the three shrimp and the gamberoso guide, which is like the best like traditional style osteria of each of the regions. So she is like the star of Lazio. So we had some cacio e pepe, we had some
Oh my gosh, is she there tomorrow?
Yes,
oh, I'm going. I'm going.
You
for
have
lunch.
To go.
Oh, yeah. I'm here for the gospel brunch. I'm going for dinner.
Yeah, you should go. Highly recommended.
Wow.
She's a trip. Yeah. You was can't it, miss her. She has giant red glasses like this big.
Did you know her?
Yes. Yes,
oh,
yes.
Was she surprised to see
yes,
you?
Yes, she was.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
I have a pic. I got to show you this picture. It's
okay.
Hilarious.
So I'm so lucky to see this.
This is really, really funny. I can't wait to post this on social media.
So let's get this over with. How did you like Expo?
So here's the picture. Look how excited she is to see me.
You have to send it to me, and we'll post it on the radio show. Yeah, look at her. I think
she
does look asleep. Well, you didn't tell me. She must be 80 years old, huh?
Yeah, she's not.
No, she's a.
Oh yeah, because her son.
And she's still.
50.
I love the red apron.
Yeah.
And the red
and
toque.
Giant red glasses.
And they're. I guess that's her color, huh?
She's the truth. She really is.
Oh, you have to send me that picture.
Yeah, I will.
We got to put it. We have to put it on the website.
Okay.
So let's quickly take a diversion here because I want to get back to your you know, pasta flyer and all
oh,
of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So quickly for our listeners out there, what are your impressions of Expo in 3 seconds?
obviously, it's very well designed. Visually, it's incredibly impactful. Obviously, a lot of time and energy, resources, and certainly money went into producing what I'm sure is going to be a tremendous event. I mean, it just started. It's not that busy yet, but I can see that it will be. And it's certainly built to be able to accommodate seas of people.
Actually, the first day, they had close to 250,000 people, and it didn't look crowded. And so today, I think when you were there, there were over 200,000 people.
You can barely see from one side to the other.
Yeah, it's huge. And
the design details are super, super nice. Like everybody, all the representatives definitely really, put a lot of work into their pavilions.
Mm-hmm. High points for you?
I would say the bottom level of the American Pavilion was by far my favorite.
Really?
I found it to be the most inspirational with the 7 vignettes. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was incredibly innovative the way that you did the whole video montage thing. Mm-hmm. With some, animation blended with video.
Video, yeah.
Yeah. And then the way it was displayed on the sheets, it blew me away. I thought it was amazing.
Oh, good. All right.
And the hanging gardens as well.
Oh, our vertical farm.
Yeah. So cool. Yeah, so cool. We also went to Iran, which was really interesting. I mean, how often do you get to go to Iran?
Yeah. What impressed you there?
They had some like pistachios, and they had a lot of plants too. More than I guess everybody had a lot of green. It was interesting to see how people interpreted the theme.
Yeah.
Certainly, some did it better than others.
Which is feeding the planet had to feed 9 billion people in 2050.
50, yeah. I found the American one to be the most informative, but I might be, a little bit partial.
Yeah. Okay. So let's get back to Del Posto. Just, I know we can't delve in it a lot, but because I want to get to Pasta Flyer and your gluten-free venture, which I find fascinating. But when you took over the helm in 2005 of Del Posto, what did you want to accomplish in that restaurant?
My focus and my the things that the reason that I took the position initially, because I had been at Lupa for 5 years, I was already a partner at very, very well, and intended to be a 4 or at that time even a 500 seat restaurant with an enormous staff. I never considered myself to be that type of chef. I didn't think that I had a broad enough skill set to be able to manage on that level. I definitely didn't have the repertoire of dishes or of experience to pull off a restaurant that was is elaborately or curated. So it started pretty bumpy in the beginning. A lot of us, you know, we underestimated a lot of challenges. We also were trying to do something that there wasn't really any precedent for. So we didn't really have anyone to look toward for inspiration. There are no restaurants like that in Italy. There were at that time no restaurants like that in the U.S. either. I knew that if I was going to work in a kitchen all day, every day, I might as well be in a nice kitchen, because at the time, Lupo was a typical New York kitchen of that day, of its day. And, you know, I was like, how many people could possibly want to come for my food on a given day? Like, this is going to be an easier way. Not easier, but just a more civilized way to live as a professional chef. It's not, you know, untrue. And after many years, Joe's initial vision really, really did work. It just took patience and it took a lot of, you know, perseverance. The idea was that, you know, we had this massive place. It also, you know, initially it was supposed to be a more casual thing. But then with the trajectory of Joe's and Mario's career, it just sort of became a more and more ambitious project. And then the more it went over budget, the more it had to be ambitious to sort of justify the expenditure and so on and so forth. So the idea was that, you know, we would garner, you know, positive critical press, which would then feed the private dining business, which would in turn subsidize the a la carte to a certain degree. So it would be this sort of like symbiotic thing, which works amazingly. It took a long time.
Yeah. How hard is it to work with two very strong personalities?
They work really well together. They are sort of the belief that, I think ultimately they both want the same thing, so it doesn't really allow for much conflict. And I've been working with them now for almost 20 years, so I feel like I'm able to create sort of in their image to a certain degree. Also, my image is like sort of intimately woven into theirs, so it's sort of the same thing at this point. I definitely feel like I make sure that when I'm making decisions that I'm taking into consideration the way that they would expect things to be. So it's not really that much.
I guess after 20 years.
Yeah, they also have like so much stuff going on. Like, I mean, I'm just one of their restaurants, you know.
Well, you're not just one of their restaurants, yeah. But the 4 stars from the New York Times certainly doesn't make you just one of their restaurants. Okay, let's get on to Pasta Flyer. This is gluten-free pasta. You were up at Harvard, the public school. What is it? Open to the public, the Science and Cooking public lecture series for the Pasta Flyer. Tell me about it. How did it start?
So, yeah, Pasta Flyer is kind of the a more modern extension of sort of my answer to this void that I have from having left Lupo all those years ago. So as much as I love Del Posto, it's a dream to be able to work really more as a curator than as a cook. I don't do a lot of cooking. I do more managing and more like overseeing a vision and making sure that things are, you know, cohesive and working like, you know, more in the future rather than the day-to-day operational stuff, protecting the vision and trying to evolve it. But, you know, it's an expensive fine dining restaurant, and it doesn't allow for, you know, everybody to have access. And, you know, it's a little bit elitist, which is fine, but, you know, I don't consider myself to be an elitist person, and I need, like, a part of me that's able to embrace more of a, you know, populist culture. So
I mean, gluten-free is a is very specific, let's say. So this isn't like making popular food. What brought you to gluten-free?
Well, that really came out of, you know, a lot of the creative energies at Del Posto for the last 5 years or so have been focused around managing and mitigating allergens, dietary intolerances, and then it evolved further into dietary preference. We feel that in 2015, fine dining should be, you know, sort of revisiting more traditional hospitality and giving people what they want. A lot of restaurants, especially smaller restaurants like, you know, food bars and things like this, where they're like cooking this really extended menu and everybody gets the same thing and there's no exceptions and there's no menu. We are sort of the antithesis of that, trying to re-embrace cooking for people, cooking them what they want rather than what I want. And, you know, also being a larger restaurant, having to appeal to a broader demographic of people, it's not uncommon for us to do a table of, say, 12. So if there's 12 people at one table, it's more likely that there will be people that have aversions to certain types of ingredients. So we started having to create food to, you know, navigate around that. So gluten-free being sort of the low-hanging fruit, excuse me, of allergens, we started making pasta that was gluten-free, and then we had a gluten-free version of every one of the pastas, and then, you know, the more we practiced, the better they got, some certainly performing better than others. But my personal favorite is dry pasta semolina, and I thought that it would be really interesting to be able to try to make a pasta that was gluten-free, but that, you know, was able to embrace all of the satisfaction that you get from chewy semolina pasta. And I feel like we have. So at the same time, we were trying to, you know, create a concept that was sort of like a fast, fresh, casual thing. I figured out a way to cook this pasta in 15 seconds. So I can make you perfect al dente gluten-free pasta in 15 seconds.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
And I've not tasted it, but I'm sure
it's pretty damn good.
I think everyone can tell how humble you are. If you say it's pretty damn good, I'm sure it's...
I mean, I like to eat it. And like I said, like, you know, that's really enough for me. Like, I feel like if I can make it good enough that I'm satisfied, then...
So tell me about Pasta Flyer Truck.
So my girlfriend, Nastasia Lopez, who you know, she worked with you at the...
At the school.
With Dave Arnold in the creative department. What was the department
called? Oh, Department of Culinary Tech. We were always ahead of the curve.
You were way ahead of the curve.
You know, Alice Waters is a dean of sustainability in the 90s when people couldn't spell it, you know? And then Dave, you know, we were the first school. Well, you know, it's always... And now it's just part of our culture.
Desiree and Alma? I mean,
I know. We've got
Alma's
some other stuff
insane,
on there.
Yeah. And now the West Coast.
We have the West Coast, but we're also talking with... Jose Andres about doing something in Spain, so it's kind of exciting.
Cool.
Yeah, you're going to like that one, too.
I will.
Yeah.
I will.
But, so go on. So tell me about the pasta flyer.
I used to work on this concept as a hobby during our time off, and it continued to evolve, and then we were like, we really want to do something with this. How do we make this happen? We don't really have any money of our own. We are both gainfully employed and not in a position to leave our current jobs. So Nastasia had experience with crowdfunding. She had already done two, one for the Searsall and one for MOFAD. So we did a Kickstarter campaign, a flyer, to do a Northeastern Collegiate Corridor tour. Because we were hoping to sort of, you know, we wanted our target demographic to be millennials. And, you know, growing up in and around Harvard Square, I was always really partial to, you know, those collegiate communities. Not necessarily the students, but the communities that support the universities. Mm-hmm. Also knowing from experience that, you know, those schools also often tend to be some of the largest real estate holders in those communities. Mm-hmm. So if you could get a relationship with the school and have them be, you know, get a favorable leasing deal with them and then also be supporting their communities, you know, they, you'll notice in the Northeast, some of these schools, their campuses are becoming so large that they don't have enough resources on it or in it to really, like, support
all
this stuff. Yeah, all the faculty, all the, you know, the groundskeepers and all the other administrators and people that it takes to run these huge companies. So that was our strategy. So we started in Harvard because of the Michael Brenner.
I was going to say fond memories of skateboarding
and the food and science lecture series. I was invited to speak about elasticity, which is something that I had been researching pretty extensively for the past couple years. Elasticity and plasticity and how they meet to create that al dente texture, mm-hmm. which is something that I was really, really obsessed with, because gluten-free pasta, by definition, cannot have that texture. So obviously that was an incredible opportunity and privilege. From there, we went to Johnson & Wales.
Is that available on the internet?
Yeah.
Okay, so if you go to YouTube and you just put in Mark Ladner, Harvard
series, absolutely.
And you'll find it, and so we can find out what you think about elasticity and pasta.
Yes. Right. I've been invited to do it again this coming year as well, so I'll be back there at the end of September.
Oh, great.
Yeah, to do it again, so, yeah.
So what's your next challenge that's fascinating you at the moment?
So now we did this tour. We fulfilled all of our obligation to Kickstarter, and we're trying to build a business model that we can try to seduce some investors to start a company called Pasta Flyer that and try to propagate the Northeastern Collegiate Corridor with these kiosks that produce, dry pasta, in 15 seconds, and then all the other delicious and healthful, nourishing Italian accompaniments that go along with the meal.
Is there a short answer to telling me how you do it in 15 seconds?
It's proprietal.
I'm glad to hear that. We're moving into when you say
recipe.
That's right.
No, it doesn't involve any sort of like patent protection or anything like that. So we're just
You keep it a secret. Well, and that's what you were talking about earlier, that a chef today has to know so much more than just knife skills and kitchen protocols and technique. And there's so much demand on from PR to entrepreneur skills. Well, as you can hear in the background, the guests are starting to come in and dinner's coming in. I can't thank you enough for taking time out. I mean, literally, everyone's coming in, and you've got to get back to our James Beard Award winner, our first chef. We're so proud to have you here, and honorary Dr. Mark Ladner. Thanks for coming. And thank you, everyone. See you next time.
Awesome. Great. Thanks for your time.
That was, no, thank you. It was wonderful.
listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.